Welcome to the annual Malinowski Memorial Lecture at the Lund School of Economics. Although it's nearly 50 years, it's nearly more than 50 years since his death, the influence of Malinowski is still very much with us. Just before coming to this lecture, I looked at the Social Science Citation Index for last year, and last year only, there were more than 170 entries under his name, far more than for any other living or dead British anthropologist. The Malinowski Memorial Lecture is traditionally given by an anthropologist who is just reaching the peak of their productive life, and this is very much the case with this year's lecturer, Anne-Christine Taylor. In spite of her name, she is one of the leading younger French anthropologists who specializes in the field of lowland South America. Now, this area might seem very remote from the interests of Malinowski himself, but of course that would be to forget that Malinowski's last fieldwork was also in Latin America. There's, however, a much more important and significant connection between her and the effective founder of our department. Together with Philippe Descola, her work on the Achuar Jivaro represents one of the finest recent examples of the kind of long-term participant observation which Malinowski initiated, and which is still fairly rare in France. This fieldwork was a mutual field enterprise with Philippe Descola. However, Philippe Descola describes in his recent book how, when Anne-Christine left, the intellectual curiosity and impetus of the project somehow seemed to dry up. The mutuality of the fieldwork, however, has led to quite distinctive theoretical approaches from the two co-fieldworkers. Anne-Christine's work represents an original approach which marries French structuralism with the more historical and symbolical analysis with which we are more familiar. Indeed, she published recently an article in the last number of the journal Man. The result of this combination is a subtle but a quite precise and distinctive voice, which we're about to hear. The title of her lecture is The Soul's Body and Its Afflictions, an Amazonian Perspective on the Nature of Being Human. Anne-Christine Taylor.
Amongst the many things that go without saying, one is how very deeply honored I feel by your invitation to deliver this lecture. Honored, but also, of course, horrified. First, because the occasion evokes a host of father figures, live or dead, we've all sharpened our teeth on in our youth, and whose benevolence is therefore open to doubt. Second, because I am a French anthropologist, and in the energetic skirmishing, which is one of the great pleasures of the long relationship between our two scientific communities, I find the stakes have suddenly been drastically risen. Third, simply because picking one's way in the minefield that has been made of anthropology nowadays by the manic jostling of conflicting paradigms is an inherently stressful affair. So, frontways, upways, and downways, the horizon is unquestionably daunting. The problem I want to deal with lies squarely in the province memorably explored by Malinowski, that of the relation between social environment and individual psychology. Indeed, it is some sort of response to the call he made in the introductory chapter of The Argonauts to study what concerns man most intimately, that is, the hold which life has on him. By attempting precisely to define what being alive and experiencing the selfhood of a socially constructed body implies for an individual from an Amazonian culture. Much research has been devoted recently to issues of this sort, so much so that the body has, to a large extent, come to replace society as our discipline's major focus of analytic elaboration. In fact, we have been taught, most notably by Marilyn Strathern, that society is nowhere, if not in the body, in the sequence of sets of relations involved in constructing and deconstructing it. This perspective deals effectively with the many difficulties raised by sociological reification, but it is not easy to reconcile with any plausible view of selfhood, insofar as it is hard to imagine that people actually experience themselves purely as a succession of structured concatenations of bits and pieces, and even harder, in the absence of subjectivity, to account for the relative continuity of tradition. Thus, while building on this work, my aim is to show how a body image is subjectivized, and how a person is thereby capable of reproducing the social structures that have shaped his selfhood. This is admittedly an absurdly large question, but its very magnitude invites the kind of hit-and-run approach ideally suited to the format of a short conference, particularly, of course, if we take heed of Nietzsche's claim that great problems are like cold baths. One must get in and out of them as quickly as possible. I shall take as my starting point a minor paradox implicit in the ethnography of lowland South American indigenous cultures. Anthropological accounts of these groups are replete with statements to the effect that Amazonian Indians do not believe in death from natural causes. Rather, they view it as a consequence of malignant human agency calling for retribution. In such a perspective, death exists only as a mode of homicide, overt or clandestine, and this conception of mortality is thought to lie at the heart of two highly important fields of social practice, namely shamanism and various forms of institutionalized feuding and hostility between domestic groups, between segments of tribes, between tribes or ethnic entities. On the other hand, in all these groups, we invariably come across one or several myths about the origin of mortality, in which death seems to be viewed in a far more naturalistic, light, as a feature of the world, in short, as an inescapable fact of life. That Amazonians do, after all, seem to conceive death as some sort of universal natural phenomenon, and the obvious rationality of this belief from our point of view, insidiously leads many anthropologists into a familiar kind of spontaneous functionalism whereby the vindictive view of mortality comes to appear as an ideological device necessary for and inherent to the continuity of major sociological institutions, the underlying assumption being that the Indians do not believe in it as they believe in the naturalistic view of death. After all, if people are destined to die anyway, it seems unnecessarily redundant to assume that they are always being murdered. Thus, the homicidal approach to mortality tends to be dealt with as if it were merely a ruse of sociological reason. Now, this really won't do, as indeed any anthropologist who stops to think about it immediately recognizes. If only because ideology is obviously experienced as truth and not as false consciousness. Furthermore, the Indians would, in fact, appear on empirical grounds to believe in the homicidal view much more strongly than in the naturalistic one. This leaves us with the problem of accounting for the coexistence of two seemingly contradictory premises. It can, of course, be argued, and often is nowadays, that the notion of logical coherence in the set of representations particular to a given society is no more than an anthropological construct, and that accounts which present cultures as self-contained, logically flawless, implicit metaphysics bear absolutely no resemblance to the way people actually think and act. Given, on the one hand, the ubiquity of those processes of creolization many anthropologists underline in their studies, and, on the other hand, the compartmentalization of mental processes that cognitivists argue for, we should allow for and indeed expect contradiction. Let me state at the outset that, in general terms, I entirely endorse the cognitivist critique of traditional anthropological views of culture, such as those developed by Pascal Boyer or Maurice Bloch in their recent work. It is perfectly true that nobody actually thinks what anthropologists seem to be making them think, and that people do not refer to a blueprint of their culture, as one would to a text, in order to produce non-contradictory statements and practices. At the same time, I strongly oppose the view that there is no stable systematicity in culture beyond that produced by anthropological accounts, or beyond that locally induced by the dialectics of ethnicity. The fact that culture rests to a large extent on that which goes without saying does emphatically not mean that anything goes, and that there is not some form of coherence between compartmentalized mental models. This is sheer common sense. Yet the nature and source of this coherence is not so easy to define and account for. If we take the cognitivist perspective seriously, it can only lie, I think, in a certain property of circularity inherent to the mental models shared by people of any given culture, in the fact, in other words, that these self-evident, discursively unelaborated conceptual clumps, which I will, for convenience sake, call premises, must refer back to each other, and that it is precisely from this circular process of mutual referral that they gain their quality of obviousness. In what follows, I will attempt to show how a unique, precise, and intricate definition of person and selfhood emerges from just such a chain of circular, unelaborated notions. In other words, how a complex idea comes to be developed while no one actually thinks it. And this, of course, raises the problem of what anthropological accounts can and should describe, an issue I will return to later on. The Jibaro Nachuar of lowland eastern Ecuador offer a perfect exemplification of the implicit contradiction I mentioned at the outset. In their view, illness and death are, invariably, the outcome of an act inspired by deliberate homicidal intentionality, operationalized through recourse to the invisible machinery of bewitchment by means of invisible blow darts. Further, they make no stark distinction, even lexically, between illness and death, the difference between the two states being a matter of degree rather than of kind. This implies that both are viewed as a process linked by a series of metamorphoses rather than as ontologically distinct conditions. Moreover, illness is a single, massive phenomenon, whatever its symptoms, whether psychic or somatic. There are no illnesses, in short, just undifferentiated suffering. Like most other Amazonians, however, The Achuar also tell a characteristically brief and concise myth stating how mortality came to be through an accidental and entirely trivial act of disobedience. I have no intention of elaborating on this myth, which ends with the lapidary statement, "Let there now be mortality," beyond underscoring two of its important features. First, this myth posits a massive and abrupt change from a state of indifferentiation, only life, to life and death, that is to say, real life. But it says nothing about this brutal shift and does not describe it. In other words, it focuses on a pair of polar terms rather than on the nature of the relation between the terms that it has set up. Second, by conceptualizing the origin of finiteness as the outcome of a trivial deed of transgression, the myth establishes a huge, indeed a monstrous disproportion between cause and effect, between an act and its consequence. And this property, common in fact to many mythic accounts, can only be explained by assuming that certain kinds of myths, at least, are fundamentally anti-causal propositions. In other words, they do not, as used to be thought, not least by Malinowski, justify and explain how the world came into being and how one should behave. Rather, they describe the world in a problematic way and make the obvious paradoxical, which is precisely why no one believes in what myths say in the way one believes in the description of a spirit. If this is so, what distinguishes our two perspectives on mortality is not a matter of content, but of form. One of them, the homicidal view, presents death as a gradual process, the extremes of which remain undefined, and its emphasis lies on exploring the nature of the processual relationship between the unmarked poles. The other, the mythic and naturalistic one, presents sharply defined terms in a paradoxical and therefore undefined relationship. Thus, what appeared initially as a contradiction between contents, that is to say, between two different conceptions of death, may now be viewed as a probably necessary articulation between two distinct representations of a relation, or more accurately, between two ways of framing this relation. To understand the nature of this articulation, we must begin by taking a closer look at mortality as a mode of processual relationship. And this, in turn, entails understanding what being alive is in Hivaroan terms. At a certain level, the answer to this question is quite simple. Being alive is to be perceived and to perceive oneself as a person, a notion locally covered by the term shua. As is commonly the case, this expression refers to a multi-layered package of relations between contrastive terms. Thus, according to context, the term shuar refers to my bilateral kindred group as opposed to others, my local group as opposed to other territorial groups, us achuar as opposed to other Hivaroan tribal units, us Hivaro as opposed to whites or other Indians, and so forth. In short, the term functions as a generalized us-them classifier. For our purposes, the interesting thing about this classifier is that in given contexts, the us it defines includes two classes of imaginary entities. One of these classes refers to spirits characterized by normal human appearance and entirely inhuman behavior. They are solitary, blind, do not eat, and exist in a state of permanent generalized desire. The other class includes spirits with a non-human appearance who are nevertheless credited with standard human behavior, that is to say, the use of language and signs, normative sociability, and so forth. In fact, a large portion of Hivaroan mythology is devoted to the description of these latter creatures' acts, and entities of this sort also figure prominently in shamanic discourse and practice, as well as in garden and hunting magic. However, if these imaginary beings can in certain circumstances be defined as persons, a part of us, in other contexts, they are quite distinct from real persons, some because they are actually a certain kind of dead person, others because they ordinarily bear no resemblance to humans. What they share with real live humans is consciousness and intentionality. In other words, animate existence. For the Achuar, in effect, life or animation is not a property specific to certain categories of things, but rather a state of potential subjectivity attributed contextually or permanently to a wide array of different things. Life, in short, is a postulated state of mind rather than of being. It follows from this that being a live, real human in Hivaroan perspective lies somewhere at the crossroads of bodily appearance, communicative and social behavior, and states of consciousness. More accurately, it lies in a particular combination of these attributes. In order to specify this combination defining live, real humanness, we may begin by taking a closer look at bodily appearance and explore in particular Achuar notions concerning the body. Let me sum up some of the salient features of the mental model that shapes these ideas. First, and most surprisingly, the Achuar have no genetic theory and have in fact very little to say about the conception and formation of a child. Questions about these matters clearly strike them as irrelevant. Further, pregnancy and birth are not at all ritualized, and there are no myths about conception and procreation beyond those relating to a switch from lethal caesarean to natural childbirth. This leads me to believe that birth is not viewed by the Achuar as a process of transformation, and there is therefore no parallelism between entry to and exit from the state of being a live, real human. Secondly, if we examine the field of prohibitions and observances linked to bodily substances and functions, a set of practices often considered strategic for understanding indigenous ideas about the body's formation and the shaping of the person, some interesting properties emerge. Prohibitions are most numerous and stringently observed precisely in those situations involving, from the indigenous point of view, a process of transformation, manufacturing a canoe, preparing curare poison, suffering from snake bite, for example. Thus, the relative scarcity and laxity of prohibitions attendant on pregnancy and childbirth supports the view that these conditions are not seen in the light of a process of change or fabrication. Further, in terms of their effects, bodily substances do not refer to a class separate from that of other non-bodily substances. Semen, for example, has the same properties as curare, as snake poison, as the fire of red pepper. Menstrual blood is just blood, or the potency of red, or that of heaviness. Finally, things posited as alive do not possess organically or physiologically differentiated bodies. A man, a bat, or a dog, or for that matter, a manioc plant, are all organized in the same way, function by identical physiological processes, and their bodily stuff, appearance apart, is the same. If we do not see this fact in ordinary circumstances, it is for epistemological reasons and not because these metabolisms are ontologically distinct. We are thus led to the conclusion that what differentiates species is shape, or more accurately, bodily appearance. Now, perceived shape refers, in Chivaroan perspective, to a finite set of particularized corporeal outlines, particularly faces, specific to each class of animate beings. These outlines exist in limited numbers and are endlessly recycled, which explains why there is no natural creation, why birth is not viewed as a process of transformation or fabrication that adds something to the world. Birth is a postulated reappearance, and the Achuar person thus comes ready-made in terms of bodily appearance. It follows from this that the Chivaroan sense of self cannot, as Western post-Freudian notions would have us believe, derive from a gradually built-up experience of organic wholeness, since specific organisms are precisely what Chivaroan bodies are not. It can only derive, in fact, from a sense of singularity of form. And yet, it flies in the face of common sense to assume that the Achuar actually experience themselves as purely generic and impersonal or anonymous singularities. Generic, particularized shape may give the self wholeness, but it obviously cannot give it subjectivity. However, subjectivity is, of course, primarily a matter of refraction. It takes its source in the perception one has of others' perceptions of self. And therein lies the answer to the conundrum I have just raised, how the experience of an impersonal, received body can become subjective. It lies, in other words, in the web of notions about affect and memory. If by memory, we mean the mental image of people and things. Now, memory, as we all know from reading Pete Gow's fine book, is intimately linked to kinship. Indeed, in some sense, is kinship itself. Social relations, in this view, are the memory of the affective mood built up by daily interaction in nurturing, sharing, and working. And the personal mental image one has of others as kin is molded by this web of feeling. Therefore, the image of self, insofar as it is based on the introjection of what one senses of others' images of it, is necessarily suffused with the memory others have of you. Subjectivity being predicated on intersubjectivity, we may understand why vision, language, and more generally communication is such a vital axis in defining a selfhood, since refracted image is to a large extent an implicit and at times an explicit description. The Achuar themselves are acutely aware of this fact, as may be inferred from, amongst other things, the structure of magical love songs. These are invariably verbal descriptions addressed to the beloved of the state he or she is experiencing on seeing, or rather on feeling, a magically induced image of the sender. Now, sociality as inherently affective memory is something that has been described with great finesse and insight by what we in Paris call the English School of Americanism, at least in our politer moments. Nevertheless, our colleagues' accounts have often struck me as somewhat one-sided, indeed as, in some senses, surprisingly ironic. For they tend to neglect or downplay a vital component of social relations, namely hostility or vindictiveness. And while the English are very good on love, I think we French have the advantage of them in the matter of hate. Now, hostility is a particularly important aspect of social relations and the psychological configurations inherent to them. Above all, of course, in a society such as that of the Quiberons, which is structured by endemic feuding and intertribal warfare with a very high level of open homicide. And learning to hate, or rather imbibing hate from the fabric of the social environment, is just as important to them as growing to love. And of course, hostility also feeds into the experience of self. It colors, just as much as love does, the texture of the body image as singularized appearance that lies at the heart of Quiberon selfhood. It is precisely a representation of this generically singular, yet uniquely individualized image of the person that is covered by the vernacular expression of wakan, a term usually translated as soul, and which in fact denotes the reflected image of a thing, the appearance of someone in a dream, as well as the dreamer's consciousness, and the ghost of a recently deceased person, that is to say, a memory mutilated of itself, a substantification of the intersubjectivity built into the image of a bodily shape that no longer exists. In sum, the Achoir would certainly endorse Wittgenstein's claim that the body is the best image we may have of the soul, not least for its reversibility, since it is equally obvious to them that the soul is also the best image we may have of the body as a generic, personalized form. If selfhood as person is a state, it is also by nature a highly unstable one, insofar as one's inner landscape is shaped by the understanding one has of others' perceptions of oneself. The integrity of one's own feeling of self is thus vulnerable on two counts. First, it is exposed to the death of others, the shattering of bits of that mirror on which it is dependent, an all too frequent occurrence in the course of an actual life, and one that provokes, as its first reaction, intense socially directed anger. Second, it is exposed to the chronic instability and uncertainty of relations in a society based on open kindred groups, the frontiers of which constantly shift in the flux of endemic feuding and changing alliances. And this is where illness comes in. Quiberon illness, I would claim, is the suffering felt when a person becomes overwhelmed by the ambiguity of his or her social environment and loses thereby a clear sense of his or her selfhood, when his perception of self, in short, becomes clouded by uncertainty. In fact, I would surmise that it is the high level of anxiety generated by the extreme lability of social relations inherent to Quiberon existence that explains why any affliction, regardless of its origin and apparent benignity, turns into a symptom of bewitchment if it lasts for more than a few days or even a few hours, and why the relatively detailed taxonomy of pathologies that the Achuar develop in the abstract so rapidly breaks down into a single massive contrast between health and undifferentiated suffering, that is to say, dying. And it is, of course, this breakdown of certainty or clarity in perception of self, experienced as suffering and conceptualized as an intangible homicidal onslaught, that justifies recourse to shamanic therapeutic practice. This is a form of cure predicated, as Carlo Severi has demonstrated for the Kuna healing of madness, on the buildup of a complex pragmatic structure wherein the shaman produces a description, generally incomprehensible to the patient, of his, the shaman's, communicative interaction with foreign spirits, more precisely, spirits posited as foreigners. He thereby creates an analogon to the patient's state of confusion, the latter's inability to traffic with himself in unproblematic ways, with this crucial difference that he, the shaman, masters this world of confusion by word and sight and communicates with its denizens through the medium of his auxiliary spirits, whereas the patient, for his part, is locked into a state of communicative breakdown, both internal and external. It is through this transmutation of dumb internal chaos to clarified, structured, explicit though incomprehensible alterity that people are restored to a normal state of self, that is, one in which self and the world can coexist at acceptable levels of uncertainty. There is, however, another Hivaroan way of dealing with the fragility of selfhood. This is by resorting to a ritual experience, which is in many ways a mirror image of the shamanic cure. I refer here to the quest for so-called Arutam visions, whereby a person may, in the course of a private ritual involving rigorous fasting and the ingestion of large doses of hallucinogenic drugs, receive a message or a vision relative to the seeker's future existence. In the case of men, this message usually concerns the outcome of an act of war or a revenge killing, which they then, of course, feel compelled to put to execution. In other words, the Arutam experience is directly linked to those situations and fields of relations most heavily fraught with unpredictability. And the spirit the seeker receives this message from is, in the last instance, the image of a dead Hivaroan individual who, after a complicated series of metamorphoses, appears briefly in person and addresses him. I need not add that the pragmatic structure of the interaction between seeker and spirit is just as complex as that implied by shamanic curing, indeed in many ways more so. I will therefore limit myself to underscoring two salient features of the Arutam experience. First, it centers on a certain manner of framing the normal interaction on which subjectivity is built. Thus, when the Achuar speak of incorporating the Arutam's message as soul, they are hypostasizing an introjection of the Arutam's description of their future selves. And just as the wakan, the body's soul, briefly survives the recently deceased as a substantification of their memory, that is, the intersubjective lineaments of their subjectivity, so the Arutam vision he or she has received survives durably as a reification of a subjectivity enhanced by a special kind of intersubjectivity. And this, in fact, is all that ultimately remains of people in the guise of the Arutam they eventually become themselves. In the second place, the effect or result of the Arutam quest springs from an event of hyper-communication, a kind of saturation of certainty and unambiguous meaning. Yet, this glimpse of a destiny cleansed of unpredictability must remain indescribable, simply because it is rigorously prohibited to speak about the message. Were one to do so, one would immediately lose the benefit of the vision, indeed the vision or message itself as soul or soul stuff, whereby the sense of self is fortified. And that, after all, is the prime motivation for undergoing the mystical experience, as well as its final outcome. The acquisition of invulnerability, made manifest by forcefulness of speech and manner, face painting of a certain kind, and heightened anger, that is to say, intensified homicidal impulse. Thus, if we compare the two kinds of ritual experience I have briefly evoked, the shamanic cure and the Arutam quest, we have, on the one hand, a mediated description of mastered chaos, whereby an individual may rid himself of the suffering occasioned by overwhelming ambiguity and the erosion of selfhood it entails, and on the other hand, a mediated secret vision or audition of absolute certainty, whereby the force of selfhood as a kind of will to power is dramatically intensified. I speak advisedly of mediation in the case of the Arutam quest, even though the seeker is alone during the ritual, because it is not the seeker himself who receives the message of the apparition, but rather his body's soul. The whole point of the drugs and fasting being to induce a state of dissociated consciousness. So in fact, the structure underlying the event of communication in both cases is similar. In the curing session, the patient is as dead, entirely passive, while the shaman gradually builds up an identification with the components of disorder, figured as foreign creatures and languages, and so orders them as he describes them. In the Arutam ritual, the seeker is also figuratively dead. In fact, his kin must avoid evoking his image as they would that of a recently deceased person, so that his soul, his de-intentionalized consciousness, may gradually become as that of the really dead person who will eventually appear to him. And from this interaction with an entity which is structurally just as outside society as are the foreigners encountered by the shaman, comes absolute clarity, not just a return to self, a healing, but rather an enhancement of self, a state of hyper-selfhood. Let me now sum up this sketchy description of the Hivaroan person and the experience of self it implies. I began by showing that the person is defined negatively, en creux, so to speak, by the intersection of a certain number of unexplicit assumptions concerning animation, viewed as imputed subjectivity, sociality, viewed as ordered communication, and therefore implicit in the indigenous notion of animation, and finally, shape, ordered surface, that principle of speciation dividing an otherwise generalized physiological model or matter. I went on to show that the surface proper to humans as a class of beings, that is to say their appearance, is conceived as a finite stock of recyclable formal singularities. Hence, the Jivaroan sense of self is predicated on the fusion of the generic body image offered by this paradigm and the interiorization of others' emotionally laden perception of this image, whereby it comes to be experienced as uniquely personal. I then argued that because selfhood is textured by intersubjectivity, because in turn intersubjectivity is textured by the form of social relations, and because the social relations are structured by the interplay between shifting kindreds and institutionalized forms of reciprocal violence, because, in short, the Achuar live in a world permeated by uncertainty and hostility, the Jivaroan sense of self is highly vulnerable. It therefore shifts between, on the one hand, states of clouding, erosion or breakdown, experienced as murderous, undifferentiated suffering, calling for shamanic healing, and on the other hand, states of enhancement brought on by a mystical experience of certainty. This leads me to the heart of my argument. In analytic terms, a person or self is not a thing, a concrete essence defined and shaped by explicit or implicit theory. In other words, an indigenous concept. Being a live human person is not a state defined as such. There is no canonized discourse about what a person is, and nobody will ever state, this is our idea of what a man or a woman is. Yet, it is an ontological condition precisely circumscribed by the articulation of a set of non-explicit premises. Being a person is thus an array of relational configurations, or a cline of states of being, if you will, a set of links in a chain of metamorphoses simultaneously open and bounded. Open because death itself is an endless process, as is the shift from us to them, from Jivaro to foreigner. Bounded, nevertheless, because being a live self can be defined only by contrastive reference either to a state of being less than alive in illness or to a state of being more than alive through the acquisition of Aruta. And this is why we may find both the stark problematic oppositions set up in mythic narratives, life versus death, and the conceptualizations of process, death in life, and vice versa, in ritual and in other fields of practice. The key, in other words, to the paradox I started out with, the coexistence of two seemingly contradictory notions of mortality. Not, in fact, two distinct compartmentalized conceptions of mortality, one naturalistic, the other vindictive, but rather two mutually implicating perspectives, one focusing on terms to the detriment of their relation, the other on the relation while bracketing the terms. Further, the portion of chain defining being is not only in one sense unbounded, it is also circular. Each modality referring to the other, each set of premises drawing its meaning and truth value from the other, thereby grounding practice, hence social forms, in the self-evident. Arutam implies both invulnerability and more killing, therefore continued social ambiguity, anxiety, and illness. Illness and death, in turn, entertain hate and feed the quest for enhancement of selfhood through Arutam, and so forth. At no point in my account have I claimed to present an indigenous theory, or even to spell out a set of implicit or unconscious collective representations about the person, about life, about death. I have simply followed a few of the links of mutual referral between clumps of things which go without saying. Yet, even my superficial presentation of this chain of relations has, I trust, been sufficient to evoke the stylistic uniqueness of Hivaroan culture. Taken separately, bits of the premises on which it is founded can be found floating all across Amazonia. Equally, the cognitive mechanisms, and more specifically, the logical structures underlying the pragmatics of Achuar culture, can also be found all over Amazonia and indeed far beyond. The particularity of Achuar culture must therefore be rooted in the establishment of a certain kind of logical circularity between these cognitive and notional bits and pieces. This is an entirely commonsensical view, and hence a very lame conclusion. But it need not be, for all that, a downbeat one. It allows us, in particular, to circumvent that situation akin to the physicist's uncertainty principle, whereby if we concentrate on cognitive mechanisms, we miss out on culture, and if we describe culture in the traditional manner, we fly in the face of what cognitive research has taught us about the workings of the mind. Cognition as such is not our province as anthropologists, because ultimately it is probably invariant. But then, culture as we used to see it isn't either. Obviously, we cannot go on saying the Achuar think that, because the content of thought we then usually go on to describe is not, in fact, what they actually think. And yet, We must, in some sense, go on saying precisely that. And this is really the good news. For it seems to me that only by spelling out, in the format of a written verbal account, the logical implications of the combination of premises found in any given culture, that we can bring to light and verify their necessary circularity, and thus check the validity of our analyses. We must, in other words, treat this net of premises as if it were a metaphysics, because this fiction is of necessity our prime, indeed our only, discovery and verification procedure. And this means that with only a slight shift of perspective, we can go on happily bashing away at our socio-cosmological monographs, provided we respect two conditions. First, we have to pay closer attention than we have to pragmatics. Cease assuming that culture is a collective text and be more realistic in our description of who thinks what and how in which circumstances. Second, we should accept to consider our ethnographic accounts as elaborate thought experiments rather than as accurate restitutions of indigenous systems of thought. To view them, in other words, simply as an instrument. Cumbersome this instrument may be, yet if we take into account the complexity of the phenomena that by common consent anthropology is supposed to deal with, our monographs must rate as highly economical instruments in every sense of the term. And the disproportion between our means, an elaborate, controlled fiction with no pretense at realistic description of mental phenomena, and our ends, the discovery and verification of links of circularity between mental models, this disproportion shrinks to nothing if we begin to think of the instrumentation deployed by the hard sciences. The only real defect of cosmological type monographs is that they are frequently boring. But then, instruments usually are. Except for people, and nowadays admittedly there are many, who happen to be more interested in instruments than in what instruments are for. The shift of perspective I have suggested isn't much to ask for, and it implies no major rehauling of object or method. Yet, it does seem to offer anthropology some kind of future as a worthwhile intellectual pursuit, which is surely more than can be said either for the bland objectivism we have long practiced, or for the self-destruct vehicle devised by the more zealous militants of postmodernism. Moreover, the sort of minor displacement of point of view I am advocating is entirely characteristic of our discipline's intellectual tradition. Indeed, the occurrence of such slight and often unnoticed shifts is precisely what makes anthropology appear to outsiders as the endless rehashing of the same problem, while its practitioners feel it to be constantly progressing. Thus, I would like to think that the banality of my conclusion is proof of sorts that the approach I am arguing for is not entirely alien to that great canon so signally shaped and illustrated by the scientist whose memory we honor today. Thank you.
It's a great pleasure to thank Anne-Christine Taylor for this wonderful lecture, which marries so well the fine and detailed ethnography which she has discussed with the very general theoretical issues which she has raised. It's so rare now that people are still willing to do this, as Malinowski did it, and it gives us courage in refusing the blandishments of those who would try to divorce the two sides of our subject. Thank you. Thank you very much.